"I know him," he said. "He's Col Jamin, of House Jamin. I served under him. What happened?"
"I thought Col died a few years back," the other guard said.
"Screw the writs," his companion snapped. "I know what I know, Vildron. This is Col, all right."
"He wants to go to the Phoenix Inn," Parron told the man. "That's the last thing he said to me." The man nodded.
"Let's do it right, though."
He turned to the other guard.
"I'll take the grief if there's any, Vildron. Get me the wagon. It's still hitched up from this morning, right?"
The guard smiled up at Parron.
"Thanks for getting him here. Some of us in the city still got eyes. And damn what the highbrows whisper. We'll put him in the back of the wagon. Less jarring that way."
Parron relaxed.
"Thanks, soldier."
He looked past the man, eager to see what he could of the city now that the wall was behind him. Immediately before them rose a humped hill, its sides overgrown with weeds and gnarled trees. On its summit squatted a temple of some kind, abandoned long ago, from which a square-sided tower rose, capped by a bronze-tiled roof. As his eyes reached the belfry's open-sided platform, he saw a flash of movement. He squinted. Ralik raised his head cautiously over the platform's edge. He almost gasped aloud. The belfry was empty. Then he remembered Ocelot's sorcery. Holding his breath, he strained one last time with leaden arms, drawing himself flat onto the platform. As soon as he moved to gather in his feet, the barren stone of the platform shimmered, and he saw Ocelot lying before him, crossbow cocked, taking aim at something below. Ralik unsheathed his knives and moved all at once, but his exhaustion gave him away, his boots scuffing the stone. Ocelot spun onto his back, weapon swinging to fix on Ralik. The clan leader's face twisted into a mask of rage and fear. He wasted no time with words and immediately released the quarrel set in his crossbow. Ralik tensed for the impact that he was certain would throw him across the platform and possibly over the edge. A flash of red before his chest blinded him momentarily, but no impact came. Blinking, Ralik looked down. The quarrel had vanished. The truth came to him in an instant. The quarrel had been magic, created by sorcery to fly unimpeded, but Barug's rusty powder had worked. Even as this thought burst into his head, he propelled himself forward. Ocelot swore and dropped the crossbow. As he reached for his knife, Ralik landed on him. A loud grunt sounded from the clan leader, his eyes squeezing shut in pain. Ralik drove the dagger in his right hand against Ocelot's chest. The weapon scraped across mail beneath the cloth shirt. Damn, the man had learned something from that other night. And this was Ralik's own precaution, come to defy him now. The blade in his left hand he angled upward, under Ocelot's right arm. The weapon's point cut into flesh, then continued on into the man's armpit. Ralik saw, inches from his face, the dagger's tip emerge from the cloth covering Ocelot's right shoulder, followed by a bloom of blood. He heard a knife skitter across the flagstones. Teeth bared, Ocelot snapped his left hand up to the back of Ralik's neck, finding his braid. He gave it a savage yank, twisting Ralik's head around. Then he tried to sink his teeth into Ralik's neck. Ocelot gasped as Ralik jammed a knee into his crotch. He tightened his hold on the braid again, this time near its knotted end. Ralik heard the snick of metal and attempted desperately to roll to his right. Wounded as Ocelot's right arm was, it struck his body with enough force to drive the wedged wrist blade through the chain links and into his chest. A dull fire blossomed from the wound. Ocelot jerked the blade free, and still holding Ralik's braid, drew back for another stab. Ralik brought up his right arm, and in a single sweeping motion, sliced through his braid. Freed, he pushed himself onto that side, withdrawing the knife in his left hand as he did so. Ocelot slashed wildly at his face, missing by inches. With all the remaining strength in his left arm, Ralik slammed his knife into Ocelot's stomach. Link snapped, and the blade sank to its hilt. The clan leader's body doubled up, curling around the embedded weapon. Gasping, Ralik lurched forward and hammered the other dagger into Ocelot's forehead. Ralik lay unmoving for a time, wondering at the absence of pain. The plan would fall to Murillo now. Cole would be avenged. Murillo could handle it. He had no choice. Ocelot's body seemed to grow heavier on him, despite the blood leaking from it.
"I'd always believed I was this man's match," he muttered.
He pushed himself from the still twitching body and rolled onto his back in the center of the platform. He had hoped to see sky, to look one last time on its bright, depthless blue. Instead, he found himself looking at the underside of the belfry's roof, its ancient stone arch crowded with nesting bats. This detail fixed itself in his head as he felt the blood stream from his chest. He thought he could see beady eyes glistening down at him. After seeing no other sign of movement on the belfry, Perrin's gaze swung to the avenue on his left. Vildron approached, seated on a wagon drawn by two horses. The guard waiting beside Cole's horse said,
"Give me a hand here, will you? Let's get the old man down."
Perrin dismounted and hurried to help him. He glanced at Cole's face. Though still hunched on the saddle, he was unconscious. How much longer could he last? If that was me, Perrin realized, I'd be dead by now.
"After all this," he growled, as they dragged Cole from the saddle, "you'd damn well better live."
Groaning, Sarat rolled onto her back. The sun beat down hot against her eyelids as the scattered fragments of her memory gathered. The Tista Andi had been about to make her move on the woman in the alley below. With that one dead, the coin-bearer's protectors would number but one. And when they left the tenement block under cover of darkness, they'd walk right into the trap she'd set. The assassin mage opened her eyes to a mid-morning sun overhead. Her daggers, which she'd held in her hands as she crouched at the rooftop's edge, now lay on the pebbled surface beside her, neatly placed side by side. A thick, dull ache throbbed in the back of her skull. She probed the wound, wincing, then sat up. The world spun, then settled. Sarat was bewildered and angry. She'd been blindsided, and whoever had done it was good. Good enough to sneak up on a Tista Andi assassin mage. And that was worrying, since they'd yet to meet such a match in Darujistan, with the exception of those two claw on the night of the ambush. But if it had been the claw, she'd be dead now. Instead, the arrangements looked to have been designed more with embarrassment in mind than anything else. Leaving her here in broad daylight, weapons beside her, hinted of a subtle and cunning sense of humor. Opon? Possibly, though gods rarely acted so directly, preferring unwitting agents culled from among the mortal masses. One certainty rose from the mystery, however, and that was that she'd lost her opportunity to kill the coin-bearer, at least for another day. Next time, she vowed, as she climbed to her feet and accessed her corralled Ghislaine warren, her secret foes would find her ready for them. The air around her shimmered with sorcery. When it settled, Sarat was gone. Motes of dust drifted through the dead, hot air of the Phoenix Inn's attic. The slanting ceiling rose from 5 feet along the east wall to 7 feet along the west wall. Sunlight streamed in from windows at each end of the long and narrow room. Both Crocus and Absalar slept, though at opposite ends of the room. Sitting on a crate beside the trapdoor, Mies cleaned her nails with a sliver of wood. Leaving Mallet's tenement and making their way across the rooftops to this hiding place had proved an easy task. Too easy, in fact. Arilta reported that no one on the streets had followed them. and the rooftops themselves had been empty of life. It was as if a path free of obstruction had been made for them. More of the eel's brilliance at work? Mies grunted softly.
Maybe.
More likely Mies was putting too much weight on the instinctive unease that travelled like an elusive itch along her spine. Even now she felt hidden eyes upon them, and that, she told herself, glaring around the musty attic, was impossible. There came a soft knock at the trapdoor. The door swung up and Arilta appeared.
"Mies,"
she whispered loudly.
"Breathing down your neck,"
Mies rumbled, tossing the wood sliver onto the oily floor.
"Tell Skurve this place is afire, waiting to happen."
Arilta grunted as she pulled herself into the room. She shut the trapdoor and wiped the dust from her hands.
"Getting strange downstairs," she said. "City wagon rolls up, and off comes a guard and some other fellow carrying coal between them. The old fool's near dead from a sword cut. They put him in Crupper's room a floor down. Salty's run off to find a cutter. But it don't look good. Not good at all."
Mies squinted in the dusty air, her gaze fixing on Crocus where he still slept.
"What's the other one look like?"
she asked. Arilta grinned.
"Good enough for a roll on the mat, I'd say. Said he found coal on Jamit's worry, bleeding all over the place. Cole woke up long enough to tell him to ride here. The guy's downstairs in the bar right now, eating enough for three men."
Mies grunted.
"Foreigner?"
Arilta strode to the window facing the street.
"Speaks Daru like he was born to it, but he'd said he'd come down from the north. Pale. Jinnabaris before that. He's got the soldier about him, I'd say." "Any word from the eel yet?" "We keep the lad here for now. And the girl? The same."
Mies sighed loudly.
"Crocus ain't gonna like being cooped up here."
Arilta glared over at Crocus's sleeping form.
Was the lad truly asleep? "No choice. Got word that there's a couple of guardsmen waiting at Mammoth's place. Too late, of course, but they've got damn clothes."
Arilta rubbed dust from the window and leaned forward.
"Sometimes I swear I see someone, or maybe something. Then I blink, and it's gone. Know what you mean?"
Bones creaking, Mies pushed herself to her feet.
"I think even the eel's beginning to sweat."
She chuckled.
"Life's heating up, friend. Rolling times ahead."
Arilta nodded grimly.
"Roll on, roll on."
Captain Parran refilled his tankard for the third time. Was this what that Tista Andy had meant about his luck turning? Since coming to this land, he had found three friends. Something wholly unexpected and new to him. Precious, in fact. But the Tattersail he knew was dead, and in her place, a child. Tok was dead, and now it looked like Cole would join that list. He ran a finger through a pool of spilled beer on the table, creating a river leading to a crack between two planks, then watched as the beer drained down and out of sight. He felt a spreading wetness on his right shin, but ignored it as his eyes focused on the crack. The wood had been bolted down, joining the thick planks to an equally robust frame of legs. What had Rake said? Parran rose and unclipped his sword belt. He laid it on the table, then withdrew Chance. The few regulars in the bar fell silent and turned to watch him. Behind the counter, Skurve reached for his club. The captain noticed none of this. With the sword in his right hand, he set the point into the crack and brought the weapon vertical. Working it back and forth, he managed to drive it close to half its length between the planks. Then he sat down again and reached for his beer. Everyone relaxed and spoke among themselves in shared confusion. Parran swallowed a mouthful of beer, frowning at Chance. What had Rake said? When your luck turns, break the sword, or give it to your worst enemy. He doubted Opon would accept it, however, and that meant breaking it. The sword had been with him for a long time. He had used it in battle only once, and that had been against the Hound. Faintly he heard the words of one of his childhood tutors. The man's lined face rose into his thoughts to accompany the voice.
"Those whom the gods choose," Tis said, "they first separate from other mortals. By treachery, by stripping from you your spirit's lifeblood. The gods will take all your loved ones, one by one, to their death. And as you harden, as you become what they seek, the gods smile and nod. Each company you shun brings you closer to them. 'Tis the shaping of a tool, son, the prod and pull, and the final succor they offer you is to end your loneliness, the very isolation they helped you create."
"Never get noticed, boy."
Had the shaping begun? Paran scowled. Was he responsible for taking Cole's life? The mere brush of friendship between them, enough to seal the man's doom?
"Opon," he whispered, "you've a lot to answer for, and answer for it you shall."
He set down the tankard and rose. Then he reached for the sword. Climbing the steps of the Phoenix Inn, Kalam paused. Damn. There it was again, this feeling that unseen eyes were fixed on him. The sensation, born of his claw training, had struck him 4 times in quick succession since he'd come within sight of this bar. Heeding such warnings was what kept him alive, and yet he felt no malice in that unwanted attention. Rather, it had the feel of amused curiosity, as if whoever watched him knew full well who and what he was, yet seemed unconcerned. He shook himself, then entered the bar. As soon as he took his first step into the heavy, stagnant atmosphere, Kalam knew that something was wrong. He shut the door behind him, waited for his eyes to adjust to the gloom. He heard breathing, the light scuff of furniture and clank of tankards coming to rest on tabletops. So, there were people here. Then why the silence? As the grey confines of the bar grew defined, he saw that its denizens had turned their backs to him and were watching a man standing behind his table at the far end of the room. The lantern light reflected dully from a sword thrust through the table, and the man had closed one hand around its grip. He seemed oblivious to everyone else in the bar. Kalam took a half dozen steps, coming to the near end of the counter. His dark eyes remained on the man with the sword, and a frown deepened the lines on his broad, flat forehead. The assassin stopped. Was it a trick of this damn light, he wondered.
"No," he said, startling the innkeeper behind the counter. "It isn't."
He pushed himself back from the counter, ran his eyes over the others in the chamber. All locals. He'd have to take the risk. A band of tension tightened around Kalam's neck and shoulders as he strode directly for the man, who looked to be but moments away from snapping his sword's blade. The assassin plucked an empty chair from a table in his path and slammed it down one-handed opposite the man. Startled eyes fixed on Kalam.
"Your God-given luck's holding, Captain," the assassin rumbled in low, close tones. "Sit down."
His expression, confused and frightened, Paran released his grip on the weapon and sank back into his seat. Kalam followed suit and leaned forward over the table.
"What's all this drama, anyway?"
he asked in a whisper. The captain frowned.
"Who are you?"
Behind them, conversations resumed, loud with rattled nerves.
"Ain't you guessed?"
Kalam wagged his head.
"Corporal Kalam, 9th Squad, Bridgeburners. The last time I saw you, you was recovering from 2 fatal knife wounds.
Paran's hands shot out and gripped Kalam's shirt. The assassin was too surprised to react, and the captain's words confused him all the more.
Is your squad's healer still alive, Corporal?
What?
Alive? Yeah, sure, why not? What's...
Shut up!
Perrin snapped.
Just listen, soldier. Bring him here, now. No questions. I'm giving you a direct order, Corporal.
He released his grip on the assassin's shirt.
Now move!
Kalam almost saluted, but caught himself in time.
As you command, sir,
he whispered. Perrin glared at the corporal's back until the man disappeared through the front door. Then he surged to his feet.
Innkeeper,
he called, stepping around the table.
The black man will be showing up in a few minutes with company. Send them up to Cole's room on the double,
understood? Skurve nodded. Perrin strode to the stairs. As he reached them, he glanced back at the sword.
And nobody touched that sword,
he ordered, swinging a glare across everyone in the room. Nobody seemed inclined to challenge him. With a sharp, satisfied nod, the captain ascended the stairs. On the first floor, he strode down the hallway to the last room on the right. He entered without knocking, to find Salty and a local surgeon sitting at the room's lone table. Cole's blanket-covered form lay unmoving on the bed. The surgeon rose.
It's no good, he said in a thin, reedy voice. The infection's too far along.
Perrin asked, Is he still breathing?
Aye,
the surgeon replied.
But it won't be for much longer. If the wound had been further down on his leg, I might have been able to cut it off. Even then, I'm afraid the poison spread through all of him. I'm sorry, sir.
Leave,
Perrin snapped. The surgeon bowed and prepared to depart.
What do I owe you for the services? The captain asked, remembering.
The surgeon frowned over at Salty.
Why, nothing, sir. I failed.
He left the room, shutting the door behind him. Salty joined the captain at the bedside. She wiped her face as she looked down on Cole, but said nothing. A few minutes later, she too left the room, unable to remain any longer. Perrin found a stool and pulled it over to the bed. He sat and leaned his forearms on his knees. He was not sure how long he sat there, staring down at the straw-littered floor, but the door slamming open behind him brought him to his feet. A bearded man stood in the doorway, his slate-gray eyes hard and cold.
"Are you Mallet?" Perrin demanded.
The man shook his head and strode inside. Behind him appeared Kalam and another man. The latter's gaze found Cole, and he walked quickly to the bed.
"I'm Sergeant Whiskey Jack," the bearded man said quietly. "Pardon my directness, sir, but what in Hood's name are you doing here?"
Ignoring the question, Perrin joined the healer. Mallet laid a hand over the crusted bandages. He glared up at the captain.
"Can't you smell the rot? He's gone."
Mallet frowned and leaned forward.
"No, wait. Damn, I don't believe it."
The healer took a spoon-shaped blade from his pouch and removed the bandages. Then he began to dig into the wound with the blade.
"Shadoonal's mercy. Someone stuffed this with herbs."
He drove his fingers into the wound. Cole jerked and moaned. Mallet grinned.
"Ah, that got you going, did it? Good."
He probed deeper.
"This cuts halfway through the bone," he breathed in amazement. "Those damn herbs have poisoned his marrow. Who the hell treated this?"
he asked, looking accusingly at Perrin.
"I don't know," Perrin said.
"All right,"
Mallet said, removing his hand and wiping it on the blankets.
"Move back, everybody. Give me some room. A minute later, Captain, and this man would have been striding through Hood's gate."
He pressed his hand down on Cole's chest and closed his eyes.
"And be glad I'm as good as I am. Now, Captain?"
Perrin walked over to the table and motioned for the sergeant to join him.
"First, has Adjunct Lorne contacted you yet?"
Whiskey Jack's blank look was sufficient answer.
"Good. I'm in time, then."
Perrin glanced up at Kalam, who had stationed himself behind the sergeant. You've been set up. The plan was to take the city, yes, but also to make certain you were all killed in the process.
Whiskey Jack held up a hand.
A moment, sir. You and Tattersail worked this out.
Perrin closed his eyes briefly.
She's dead. Chasing Hairlock out on the Rivi Plain. Tayshrun got to her. It was also her intent to find you and tell you all that I'm telling you. I'm afraid I won't be her equal as your ally once the adjunct shows up, but at least I can prepare you somewhat.
Kalam spoke.
I don't like the idea of Opon's pawn supposedly helping us.
Perrin nodded.
I have it on good authority that I'm not Opon's. That sword downstairs is, though. Your squad wizard should be able to confirm this.
The adjunct's plan? Whiskey Jack reminded him, the fingers of one hand tapping slowly on the tabletop.
She'll have no trouble finding you. She has a talent in that area. But I fear she's not the major threat. There's a Talanai mass with her. Maybe her mission is simply to lead him to you, then he'll handle the rest.
Kalam cursed and began pacing behind the sergeant's chair.
Whiskey Jack reached a decision.
The satchel, Corporal.
The assassin frowned, then picked up the sergeant's standard-issue supply satchel left beside the door. He returned and set it down on the tabletop.
Whiskey Jack released the straps and pulled out an object wrapped in burgundy silk. He removed the cloth, revealing twin yellowed bones of a human forearm. The elbow end's ball joints were bound together with verdigris copper wire. The wrist ends were wrapped as well, but as a misshapen knife grip, beyond which jutted a serrated blade.
"What is it?" the captain asked. "I've never seen its like before."
"Be surprised if you had," Whiskey Jack said. "Back in the days of the Emperor, the inner ring of military commanders each possessed one of these, the booty of a looted Kachane Chamala tomb."
He grasped the bones with both hands.
"It was the source of much of our success, Captain."
He rose and drove the point into the table. A flash of white light erupted from the bones, then contracted to a swirl spinning thread-like between them. Perrin heard a voice he knew.
"I was getting worried, Whiskey Jack,"
Hyphus Dujek growled.
"Unavoidable," the sergeant replied, frowning at Perrin. "We've had little to report, until now. But I need to know the situation in Pale, Hyphus." "You want an update before you spill the bad news, huh?" "Fair enough," Dujek said. "Tayshrun's stumbling in circles. He was last happy when Beladan was killed along with Tattersail. Two more of the old guard gone in one fell swoop. Since then, all he's got is questions. What game is Opon playing? Was there truly a clash between the Knight of Darkness and Shadow Throne? Did a soul-shifted puppet kidnap, torture, then murder a Claw officer in Nathalog? And what truths were revealed by the poor man?"
"We were not aware that Hairlock had done that, Hyphist."
"I believe you, Whiskey Jack. In any case, enough of the Empress's plans have been discovered, and indeed, she seems convinced that the dismantling of my army will pull me back under her wing, in time to saddle me with the command of the Seven Cities garrisons and put a bloody stop to the rebellion that's brewing. She's seriously miscalculated there. If only she'd paid attention to Tok the Younger's reports. Well, Lassine's intentions now seem to be riding on Ajak Lorn and Onos Tulan. They've reached the Jaghat Barrow, Whiskey Jack."
Mallet joined them and met Kalam's stunned gaze. Clearly, even they had no idea that their sergeant was so well informed. Suspicion dawned in the assassin's eyes, and Perrin nodded to himself. It was happening, after all. Dujek continued.
"The Maranth Black are ready to march, but it's only for show and to get them out of the city. So, what are we looking at, friend? The balance of the world is with you, in Darujistan. If Lorn and Onos Tulan succeed in unleashing the tyrant on the city, you can be certain that you and your squad are intended to be on the casualty list.
Closer to home, here's what you want. We're ready to move. Taishran himself will trigger events when he announces the disbanding of the bridge burners. The blind idiot. Now I'm waiting.
High Fist, Whiskey Jack began. Captain Parron's made it. He's sitting across from me right now. His story is that Opon's working through his sword, not him.
He met the captain's eyes.
I believe him.
Dujek spoke.
Captain?
Yes, High Fist.
Was Tok any help?
Parron winced.
He gave his life for this, High Fist. The puppet Hairlock ambushed us. Tossed Tok into a rent or something.
There was silence.
Then Dujek said, his voice hoarse,
I'm sorry to hear that, Captain. More than you know. His father? Well, enough of that. Go on, Whiskey Jack.
No success yet in contacting the local Assassin's Guild, High Fist. We've mined the intersections, though. I'll be explaining everything to my men tonight. The question remains, what to do about Captain Parron?
Understood, Dujek replied. Captain Parron?
Sir?
Have you come to any conclusions?
Parron glanced at Whiskey Jack.
Yes, sir. I think so.
So, what choice will you make, Captain?
He ran a hand through his hair and leaned back in the chair. High Fist, he said slowly. Taishran killed Tattersail. And failed. But that is a secret I will keep to myself, he thought. The adjunct's plan including betraying her word to me, and probably killing me in the process. But, I admit, that's secondary to what Taishran did. Looking up, he met Whiskey Jack's steady gaze. Tattersail took care of me, and I her after that hound. It, he hesitated, it meant something, High Fist. He straightened. So, I gather you intend to defy the Empress. But what then? Do we challenge the Empire's 100 legions with 10,000 men? Do we proclaim an independent kingdom and wait for Lassine to make an example of us? I need more details, High Fist, before I decide whether I join you. Because, sir, I want vengeance.
Dujek responded.
The Empress loses Janabakis, Captain. We've got the support for that. By the time the Malazan Marines arrive to reinforce the campaign, it'll already be over. The Crimson Guard won't even let them disembark. Expect Nathilog to rise up and Genobaris to follow. The Maranth Alliance is about to lose its punch, though I'm afraid I can't give you the details on that. My plans, Captain? They might not make sense, because I don't have time to explain. But we're readying ourselves to take on a new player in the game. Someone completely outside all of this. And that someone is damn nasty. He's called the Panion Seer, who even now prepares his armies for a holy war. You want vengeance? Leave Taishran to enemies closer to home. As for Lorne, she's all yours, if you can manage it. I can't offer you anything more, Captain. You can say no. Nobody will kill you for that.
Parron stared at his hands.
I want to know when High Mage Taishran gets what he deserves.
Agreed.
Very well, High Fist. As far as this present situation is concerned, however, I'd rather Sergeant Whiskey Jack remained in command.
Dujek asked, a grin in his voice.
Whiskey Jack?
Accepted, the sergeant answered.
He smiled at Parron.
Welcome aboard, Captain. Enough?
Dujek asked.
We'll speak again after it's all done, Whiskey Jack said. Until then, High Fist. Success.
Success, Whiskey Jack.
The threads of light faded. As soon as they were gone, Kalam rounded on his sergeant.
You old bastard! Fiddler told me Dujek wouldn't hear any talk of revolt. Not only that, the High Fist told you to walk after this mission.
Whiskey Jack shrugged,
removing the strange contraption from the table.
Things changed, Corporal. When Dujek got the adjunct's word on next year's reinforcements, it became obvious that someone was ensuring that the Jennebacken campaign would end in disaster. Now, even Dujek won't tolerate that. Obviously, plans would have to be revised.
He faced Perrin, his eyes hardening.
I'm sorry, Captain, but Lorne has to live.
But the High Fist...
Whiskey Jack shook his head.
She's on her way into the city, assuming that she and the IMAS succeed in freeing the Jaghut. The Tyrant will need a reason to come to Darujistan, and we can only assume that somehow Lorne will be that reason. She will find us, Captain. Once that happens, we'll decide what's to be done with her, depending on what she tells us. If you challenge her openly, she will kill you. If necessary, she will have to die. But her demise will be subtle. Do you have any problems with any of this?
Perrin released a long breath. Can you at least explain why you went ahead and mined the city?
In a moment, Whiskey Jack said, rising. First, he said, who's the wounded man?
Not wounded any more,
Mallet said, grinning at Perrin.
Just sleeping.
Perrin also rose. In that case, I'll also explain everything. Just let me go downstairs and retrieve my sword. At the door, he paused and turned to Whiskey Jack.
One more thing. Where's your recruit, Sorry?
Kalam answered.
Missing. We know what she is, Captain. Do you?
Yes.
But she may not be what she once was, he thought, assuming Shadow Throne didn't lie. He thought to relate that part of his story, then dismissed the notion. He couldn't be sure, after all. Better to wait and see. The burial chamber proved to be a small, nondescript beehive tomb, the low dome constructed of roughly dressed stones. The passageway leading to it was narrow and less than 4 feet high, sloping slightly downward. The chamber's floor was of packed earth, and in its center rose a circular wall of stones, capped by a single massive lintel stone. Frost-crusted objects lay on this flat surface. Tool swung to the adjunct.
The object you seek is called a finest. Within it is stored the Jaghut Tyrant's powers. It is perhaps best described as a self-contained Omtos Felak Warren. He will discover it is missing once fully awakened, and will unerringly hunt it down.
Lorne blew on her numb hands, then slowly approached the lintel stone.
And while it's in my possession?
She asked.
Your Ototeral sword will deaden its aura. Not completely. The finest should not remain in your hands for long, adjunct.
She scanned the objects scattered on the stone surface. The IMAS joined her. Lorne picked up a scabbarded knife, then discarded it. In this, Tool could not help her. She had to rely upon her own senses, honed by the strange, unpredictable effects of the Ototaral. A mirror set in an antler caught her eye. The mica surface was latticed in a web of frost, yet it seemed to glimmer with a light of its own. She reached for it, then hesitated. Beside it, almost lost among the crystalline frost, was a small, round object. It lay upon a flap of hide. Lorne frowned, then picked it up. As its ice coating melted, she saw that it was not perfectly round. She polished the blackened surface and studied it closely.
I believe it is an acorn, Tool said.
Lorne nodded.
And it's the finest.
Her gaze fell to the capped mound of rocks.
What an odd choice.
The IMAS shrugged in a clatter of bones.
The Jaghut
are odd people. Tool, they weren't very warlike, were they? I mean, before your kind sought to destroy them.
The IMAS was slow to reply.
Even then, he said at last, the key lay in making them angry. For then they destroyed indiscriminately, including their own.
Lorne shut her eyes briefly. She pocketed the finist.
Let's get out of here. Yes, adjunct. Even now, the Jaghut tyrant stirs.
Chapter 19. But someone died here, alas. Who drinks of this now and then and stirs the ashes of thine own pyre? Maker of paths, you were never so thirsty in youth. Old Temple, Seven Store, born 1022.
This isn't right, Mies,
Croker said, as he rubbed the sleep from his eyes.
We can't just hide in here forever.
Absalar said from the window,
it's almost dark.
Mies crouched once again to check the trapdoor's lock.
We're moving you again, after the 12th bell. Arilta's down below, getting details. Who's giving these orders? Crocus demanded. Have you found Uncle Mammoth yet? Relax, lad, Mies straightened. No, we ain't found your uncle, and the orders come from your protectors. I won't answer any questions about who they are, Crocus, so save your breath.
Absalar shifted position by the window to take in Mies.
Your friend's been a long time, she said. Do you think something's happened?
Mies looked away. This girl was sharp. Of course, Mies had known that the first time they'd met, and old Chert had found out the hard way.
Not sure, she admitted.
She bent to unlock the trapdoor.
You both stay put, she ordered, glaring at Crocus. I ain't going to be happy if you do something stupid, understand?
The boy looked glum, his arms crossed. He watched as Mies opened the trapdoor and climbed down the ladder.
Close this up after me, she said from below, and lock it. Wait to hear from either me or Arilta. Got it?
Yes. Crocus strode to the square hole in the floor and stared down at Mies. We got it, he said, grasping the door and swinging it shut. Then he locked it.
Crocus? Absalar asked. Why did you kill a guard?
This was their first time alone since entering the city. Crocus glanced away.
It was an accident. I don't want to talk about it.
He crossed the room to the back window.
All these people trying to protect me, he said, makes me uneasy. There's more going on than just an order for my arrest. Hood's Breath, the Thieves Guild takes care of such things. That's why they get 10% of every job I do. No, none of it makes sense, Absalar. And, he said as he unlatched the window, I'm sick of everybody telling me what to do.
She came to his side.
Are we leaving then? Damn right. It's already dusk, so we'll take the rooftops.
He pulled and the window swung inward.
Where?
Crocus grinned.
I've got a great hiding place in mind. Nobody will find us, not even my protectors. Once there, I can do what I want.
Absalar's brown eyes searched his face.
What do you want to do?
She asked softly. He looked away, concentrating on propping up the window.
I want to talk to Shalice Dahl, he said, face to face. She betrayed you, didn't she? Never mind that. Are you staying here? No, she said, surprised. I'm coming with you, Crocus.
The power of her warren bristled on her body. Serrat scanned the area one more time, still seeing and sensing nothing. She was certain she was alone. The Tista Andy tensed as the window in the attic beneath her creaked inward on rusty hinges. Knowing herself to be invisible, she leaned forward. The lad's head popped out. He glanced at the alley below, the opposite rooftops, and those to either side. Then he looked up. His gaze passed right through Sarat, and she smiled. It hadn't taken long to find him again. His only company, she could sense, was a young woman whose aura was harmless, astonishingly innocent. The other two women no longer occupied the attic. Excellent. It would be that much easier. She stepped back as the coin-bearer climbed through the window. A moment later, he scrambled onto the sloping rooftop. Sarat decided that she would waste no time. Even as the coin-bearer pushed himself to his feet, she sprang forward. Her charge met an invisible hand driving into her chest with bone-jarring force. It pushed her back through the air, giving a final shove that sent her cartwheeling beyond the roof's edge. Her spells of invisibility and flight remained with her, even when she rebounded off a brick chimney, dazed and drifting. Apsalar appeared on the roof's edge. Crocus crouched before her, daggers in hand, and glaring all around him.
"What's wrong?"
she whispered, frightened. Slowly, Crocus relaxed and turned a rueful grin her way.
"Just nerves," he said. "Thought I saw something. Felt a wind. Looked like... well, never mind."
He looked around again.
"There's nothing here. Come on, then." "Where's this new hiding place of yours?"
Apsalar asked as she gained the rooftop. He faced east and pointed to the shadowed hills rising on the other side of the wall.
"Up there," he said, "right under their very noses."
Murillo clasped on his sword belt. The longer he waited for Ralek to arrive, the more certain he was that Ocelot had killed his friend. The only question that remained was whether Kol still lived. Maybe Ralek had done enough, wounded Ocelot sufficiently to prevent the clan master from completing the contract.
"I can hope, anyway," he thought.
They'd know at the Phoenix Inn, and each minute that passed made his Spartan room seem smaller, more cramped. If Kol lived, Murillo vowed to attempt Ralek's role in the plan. He checked his rapier. It had been years since his last duel, and Turban Orr was said to be the city's best. His chances looked poor. He collected his cape and fastened the collar around his neck. And who was this circle breaker with all the devastating news? How did this eel justify involving himself or herself in their schemes? Murillo's eyes narrowed. Was it possible? That little round runt of a man? He pulled on his doeskin gloves, muttering under his breath. A scrape at the door caught his attention. A heavy sigh of relief escaped him.
"Ralek, you old bastard!" he said, as he opened the door.
For an instant he thought the hallway empty. Then his gaze fell to the floor. The assassin lay there, his clothing soaked through with blood, looking up at him with a weak grin.
"Sorry I'm late," he said. "My legs keep giving out."
Cursing, Murillo helped Ralek into the room and onto the bed. He returned to the door, checked the hallway, then shut and set the lock. Ralek pushed himself upright against the headboard.
"Or offered a contract on Kol."
I know,"
Murillo said as he approached. He knelt beside the bed.
"Let's see to your wound."
"I need to take off my armor first," Ralek said. "Ocelot stuck me one. Then I killed him. Kol's still alive, as far as I know. What day is this?"
"The same day," Murillo said,
as he helped his friend remove his mail hauberk.
"We're still on schedule, though from all this blood it looks like you won't be dueling Orr at Simtar's fate. I'll handle that."
"Stupid idea,"
Ralek groaned.
"You'll just get killed and Turban Orr will walk away, still Lady Simtal's backer, and still powerful enough to prevent Kol's claim to rights."
Murillo made no reply to that. He peeled back the leather padding to expose the wound.
"What's with all this blood on you?" he demanded. "There's nothing here but a week-old scar."
"Huh?"
Ralik probed the place where Ocelot's wrist blade had stabbed him. It felt mildly tender, itchy at the edges.
"I'll be damned," he muttered. "Anyway, get me a washcloth, so I can clean all this rust off."
Murillo sat back on his haunches, clearly confused.
"What rust?"
"The stuff on my face,"
Ralik said, scowling at his friend. Murillo leaned close.
"Baruch's magic deadening powder," the assassin snapped. "How the hell do you think I managed to kill Ocelot?"
"Your face is clean, Ralik," Murillo said. "You're welcome to the washcloth. We'll get all that dried blood off you in any case."
"Give me a mirror first," Ralik said.
Murillo found one and stood watching Ralik study his own pallid reflection, which bore a deep frown. He observed dryly.
"Well, that expression confirms it for me."
"Confirms what?"
the assassin asked in a dangerous tone.
"That you're you, Ralik."
Murillo squared his shoulders.
"Rest here for a while. You've lost a lot of blood. I'm off to find the eel and tell him a thing or two."
"You know who the eel is?"
He strode to the door.
"I've got a hunch. If you can walk, try locking this door behind me, will you?"
Crupper mopped his brow with his limp, sodden handkerchief.
"Crupper has uttered every single detail at least 1,000 times, Master Baruch," he complained. "Will this ordeal never end? Look at yon window. A whole day in Crupper's life has passed."
The alchemist sat frowning down at his slippers, occasionally wiggling his toes as the minutes passed. It was as if he had forgotten Crupper's presence in the room, and it had been this way for the past hour, no matter how much Crupper talked.
"Master Baruch," Crupper tried again, "may your loyal servant leave? He's not yet recovered from his horrific journey in the eastern wastelands. Simple fare of roast mutton, potatoes, fried onions and carrots, mussels in garlic butter, dates, cheese, smoked slipper minnows, and a carafe of wine now occupies Crupper's mind to the exclusion of all else. Such as he has been reduced, his world contracting apace with his stomach."
Baruch spoke.
"For the past year," he said slowly, "an agent of the eels, known to me as Circle Breaker, has been providing me with vital information regarding the city council."
Crupper's mouth shut with an audible click.
"It lies within my powers, of course, to identify this Circle Breaker at my leisure. I have a score of missives written in his own hand. The parchment alone suffices."
Baruch's eyes lifted to fix on the mantelpiece.
"I am considering doing so," he said. "I must speak with this eel. We've reached a critical juncture in the life of Darujistan, and I must know the eel's purposes. We could work in close alliance, sharing all we know, and perhaps we can save the life of this city. Perhaps."
Crupper cleared his throat and wiped his brow again. He carefully folded the handkerchief on his lap, then stuffed it into a sleeve.
"If you wish to convey such a message," he said quietly, "Crupper can oblige, Master Baruch."
Baruch's gaze dropped calmly to Crupper.
"Thank you. How soon the reply?"
"By this evening," Crupper said.
"Excellent. I admit to resisting my own decision to compromise this Circle Breaker. The means you offer seem the best. You may go now, Crupper."
Crupper's head bobbed. He rose.
"Until tonight, then, Master Baruch."
Carl slept while the men in the room continued their discussion. Mallet said that the man might well sleep for days, Hood's gate having been as close as it was. Parron felt frustrated. Something was missing from Whiskey Jack's explanations. The saboteurs had gone ahead with planting the mines, and even now it was Whiskey Jack's plan to detonate them. More, the efforts to contact the Assassin's Guild remained with the purpose of offering a contract on Darujistan's true rulers. These facts hardly complemented this idea of a full-scale, continent-wide revolt. If anything, wouldn't Dujek be seeking local alliances? As the sergeant went on, more and more of what the man said gathered in the captain's mind, and he sensed a pattern emerging. He broke his hour-long silence and addressed Whiskey Jack. "You still intend to cripple Darujistan. And I keep thinking about that. And now I think I've worked out why." He studied Whiskey Jack's blank expression. "What you seek is to crack this city wide open. Chaos in the streets, a headless government. Everybody who matters shows up and they kill each other. What does that leave?" Parron leaned forward, his eyes hard. "Dujek's got an army 10,000 strong, about to become outlaws of the Empire. Maintaining 10,000 soldiers is an expensive business. Housing them is even tougher. Dujek knows Pale's days are numbered, Caladan broods on the march down the Rivi Plain right now, and the Maranth about to pull out of the Alliance, maybe make a move of their own. Taishran's in Pale. Maybe old One Arm can handle him, maybe not. How am I so far, Sergeant?" Whiskey Jack glanced over at Kalam, then shrugged.
"Go on," he said to Parron.
"The Rujistan's filled with panic. No one knows anything. In marches Dujek, rebel army at his heels. He'll set things aright. Wealth beyond measure falls into his lap. And he'll need all of it if he's to oppose what the Empress sends after him. So, the city gets conquered after all. Fancy that." He sat back.
"Not bad," Whiskey Jack admitted, grinning at the surprise on the faces of Mallet and Kalam. "With one piece missing. Something," he eyed Parron, "that might relieve the captain's sense of betrayal, if not his outrage."
Parron's smile was cold.
"Surprise me." "All right, Captain."
"We don't give a damn if the Empress wants to come after us. She won't have much to do with it, since Seven Cities is days away from reclaiming its independence. It's coming down, Captain, on all sides. So why do we maintain our army?
Look to the south.
Something's growing there. So ugly it makes the IMAS look like kittens. When I say we're in trouble, I don't mean just Jenabakis. I mean the world. We're all in for a fight, Captain. And that's why we need Darujistan."
"What's to the south?" Parron asked skeptically. Kalam answered, his words a breath of fear.
"The Panyan Seer." "So the rumors are true, then. The Seers proclaimed a holy war. The genocide's begun."
Whiskey Jack got to his feet.
"Explain it to the man," he said to Kalam. "That guild still needs contacting, if possible. Who knows? We've made a show of ourselves at this bar. Might be what's needed, though."
He looked to Parron.
"Captain, I don't think Adjunct Lorne should know you're alive. Do you?"
"No."
"Can you stay here until I call for you?"
Parron glanced at Kalam, then nodded.
"Good. Mallet, let's move."
"We've lost at least 2 days," Lorne pronounced, thankful for the day's lingering heat. "These are thirsty horses."
Tool stood near the shadowed barrow marker, watching the adjunct ready her horses for the journey into Darujistan.
"How fares your wound, adjunct?" he asked.
"Mostly healed," she replied. "Ototerol has that effect on me."
"My task is finished," the IMAS said. "If it becomes your desire to accompany me after you have completed your mission, I will be found here for the next 10 days. I wish to observe this Jaghut tyrant, though it will not see me, nor will I interfere.
My thoughts of success are with you, adjunct.
Lorne climbed onto her horse and stared down at the IMAS. Farewell.